You were convinced up to that time?
Yes, sir, and I was saying that all across the country because I believed it.
And you kept saying this to the president on the basis of information which you were receiving from Mr. Dean and others?
In the best of faith, yes, sir.
All right. Then why on January the 3rd were you so concerned that Mr. Hunt might blackmail the White House?
Why was I so concerned?
Yes.
Well, any time that somebody levels a blackmail threat against, well, not, excuse me, that happened March 20th. That did not happen January 3rd.
No, didn't you meet on January the 3rd with respect to the Hunt letter?
Oh, but that was not blackmail.
Well, he was asking for help.
Yes, but he was not making any threats that I knew of.
Well, I believe the testimony which has been adduced here indicated that Mr. Hunt was getting kind of nervous, that Mr. Parkinson imparted this information, which he received from Mr. Bittman to Mr. Mitchell, and Mr. Mitchell in turn imparted it to the White House, and then this conference was convoked where you, Mr. Dean, Mr. Colson, and others were present about the Hunt letter.
I'm sorry, Senator. I don't think that's the way that meeting came about.
All right. Tell me how it came about.
My understanding is that Mr. Hunt had written a letter to Mr. Colson, and I recall seeing the letter, and that plus a telephone call from either Mr. Hunt or Mr. Bittman, and I don't remember which, to Mr. Colson's office, precipitated the meeting.
Well, why would you...
There's a vote on in the Senate, and I'm going to have to recess.
And so we have another recess while the members of this committee go to the Senate floor for another vote. We are hearing John Ehrlichman testify, being questioned by Senator Montoya, just now testifying about a series of interviews that he conducted after President Nixon gave him full authority to investigate the Watergate affair last April. Senator Montoya's questions have had very little theme to them. They've been scattered over a wide period of time and a wide period of subject matter, so it has produced, in effect, a scattering of information, not much of it new. As a result of these interviews, Mr. Ehrlichman says that he came to the conclusion that Gordon Strawn was just a messenger in this whole thing and knew nothing, really, a messenger and nothing more. He concluded that Herbert Kalmbach, the president's personal attorney, acted in the best of faith, as Mr. Ehrlichman put it, in raising and dispersing money to the Watergate defendants. And so, we'll be back with more live coverage of the Senate Select Committee hearings into the Watergate affair in just a moment.
NBC's special coverage of the Senate Select Committee hearings will continue after this pause for station identification. John Chancellor and the award-winning NBC Nightly News tonight.
Kiddies? Oh, you dear. I'm Professor Golden, while Archis will talk about Happy. What's the biggest Happy you can get at McDonald's?
Big Mac, Quarter Pounder, French fries.
Right. What's the foremost Happy you can get at McDonald's? Give up? McDonald's foremost Happy Cups. Each week you get a different Happy Cup free when you buy a large Coke, Orange, or Root beer. So be a smarty. Collect the whole Happy set.
You can get the Captain Crook Happy Cup at all participating McDonald's through Sunday, July 29th.
Now, there's another way to get this famous parquet flavor with just a squeeze.
Squeeze?
Squeeze parquet liquid margarine. You squeeze it right from the bottle. Squeeze it for frying. Squeeze it on pancakes. Squeeze it on popcorn. Squeeze parquet liquid margarine, the country fresh flavor of famous parquet, now in liquid form. Squeeze parquet liquid margarine from Kraft.
Squeezing is believing.
America, now you can go soak your parched little throat with
Nestle iced tea in cans.
We have a short recess in the Watergate hearings while the members of the committee go back to the Senate floor for another vote. This is a vote on an amendment offered by Senator Hart to the campaign reform bill. It's an amendment which would limit individual federal campaign contributions to $1,000. Earlier today, the Senate approved an amendment which would limit the amount to $3,000. The Senator Phil Hart would like to make it even stricter and keep the limit to $1,000. You remember this afternoon's session was a little late in getting started, almost a half an hour, because Senator Ervin, Senator Baker, Council Sam Dash and Council Fred Thompson were at a meeting in Senator Irvin's office. Paul Duke has learned some more details about that meeting, so we'll go outside the Senate caucus room now to Paul Duke. Paul?
Well, Doug, we have confirmed that a meeting did take place at the request of the White House. Apparently this morning there was a call from the office of Fred Buzhardt and Leonard Garment, two of the White House attorneys, wishing to meet with Chairman Irvin and the ranking Republican member of the committee, Senator Baker of Tennessee. There was a meeting which took place beginning at 2 o'clock in Senator Irvin's office. We are told that the meeting dealt with the subject which was brought up at yesterday's hearing by Senator Baker. If you remember, at one point, Baker questioned Ehrlichman about the operations of the so-called Plumbers Unit, the White House Intelligence Unit, and Ehrlichman took executive privilege, refusing to discuss one of the secret operations by the Plumbers, which took place in 1971. This rather angered Baker, who felt that it was difficult for him to tie in the operations of the Plumbers to Watergate if Ehrlichman would not give complete testimony. Well, in any event, the White House asked for the meeting today and came up and they discussed it. There is a suggestion that information was imparted to those who took place, to those who were in the meeting. And one of those who took part in the meeting was the committee's chief counsel, Sam Dash. Can you tell us more about the meeting today, Mr. Dash?
Well, all I can say is that it was a meeting. I can tell you nothing about the meeting. I can tell you that, of course, we did discuss the issues that were raised by Senator Baker that came from the interrogation of Mr. Ehrlichman concerning the missing paragraph 5 in the August 11 memorandum and the fourth activity of the Plumbers.
Well, did they tell you what that operation was?
Well, I'm not going to comment any further.
Well, don't tell us then about the meeting. Simply tell us whether we're going to get any testimony now from Mr. Ehrlichman about the missing paragraph 5.
Well, again, I will not comment further about the meeting or the discussions.
Does that mean you could not reach agreement with these representatives of the White House?
What, my no comment doesn't give you any inference as to whether we could or could not reach an agreement or anything. It's a no comment.
Well, is there going to be another meeting?
I will not comment any further about the meeting or anything about anything that was discussed or what it will lead to.
Did you discuss any other issues in the meeting, Mr. Dash?
No, this was the purpose of the meeting. It was called specifically the request of Senator Baker, and that's the limit of what I'm going to say.
Well, let's put this thing in some perspective, though. The assertion of executive privilege by Mr. Ehrlichman yesterday was the first time it had been asserted in these hearings. Now, do you expect, as a result of your meeting with Mr. Buzhardt and Mr. Garment today, that executive privilege claim will be asserted again in these hearings?
No. And as a matter of fact, executive privilege wasn't an appropriate assertion in this case. It really wasn't put as an executive privilege issue. The issue was primarily national security, and this was the position Mr. Ehrlichman was raising. This was a unique situation that was being discussed. It doesn't reflect on the testimony of other witnesses or give any indication that executive privilege will be raised on the questioning of Mr. Ehrlichman further or Mr. Haldeman or Mr. Colson.
I want to make sure I understand. You're saying then that you do not believe this national security claim will be asserted again in these hearings?
No, I don't say that.
At the request of the White House?
At the request of the White House, there may be questions which we may put, which the witness will say deals with national security. That's an issue that the committee resolves, and it resolves in executive session, and then it resolves it. It either makes a decision to go into public session with it or to do nothing with it, or to deal with it in executive session and act on it. At this point, I can't comment on what the committee might do with the information it may have received today.
Well, if that's still the status, I don't see that you resolved anything with Mr. Buzhardt and Mr. Garment today.
Well, I don't think your question is properly answered by a no comment, because the no comment doesn't give you any inference as to whether we resolved anything or not.
Well,
I just don't wish to answer your question.
Well, let me ask you this.
Right.
Were you partly satisfied by the meeting?
I'm not going to characterize the meeting as to satisfaction or not. I just won't answer any further questions.
What about Chairman Irvin?
By no comment.
Is Chairman Irvin going to make any statement on that?
No, I think Chairman Irvin will make no statement.
Well, make reference to the meeting itself and leaving that completely aside, Do you have any reason to believe that you're making progress toward obtaining public access to that missing paragraph?
Again, I won't comment on that.
Thank you very much. You, Sam Dash, the chief counsel of the Watergate Committee.
Carl, from another source, I learned that apparently the White House counsel did impart some significant information to the committee counsel and to Senator Ervin and to Senator Baker. And a short while ago, I talked to Senator Baker, who, you remember, yesterday was talking about having an executive session to discuss this with Mr. Ehrlichman. And Senator Baker said he would not comment on that, but the implication I got from him was that he didn't feel any need for this now.
Well, I gathered it was inconclusive. You talked to Senator Baker. I talked to him as well at a separate moment. I asked him, are you ever going to see that missing paragraph 5, which you did not see because of this assertion of national security or executive privilege? And he said, I don't know that we ever will. I gather that if the purpose of coming up here was to resolve that question then, that it wasn't resolved, that the White House may have made some overtures, provided some information, but that they reserved their right to assert this and witnesses assert it.
Thank you, gentlemen. A valued effort. Senator Ervin is back, has wrapped his gavel, and so these hearings will begin again.
Yeah.
We see John Ehrlichman, who left the room temporarily, returning to his seat. Committee counsel Sam Dash, who had very little to say to Carl Stern and Paul Duke, except no comment when asked about that meeting with White House counsel Leonard Garment. John Ehrlichman being questioned by Senator Montoya. And here's Senator Ehrlichman.
Mr. Ehrlichman, I believe the last question I asked you was, why was there so much concern around the White House about clemency for Mr. Hunt on January 3rd in view of the fact that you have testified that up to that time you were all convinced there was no White House involvement?
Well, if I could first take the assumptions of your question, Senator, I can't agree that there was so much concern around the White House for clemency for Mr. Hunt. The fact is...
Well, why did you have this conference?
We had the conference because Mr. Colson had a very strong concern about Mr. Hunt and his melancholy and his frame of mind and his letter which said that Mr. Colson, in effect, had abandoned his friend, and Mr. Colson was moved by this. It was the occasion for a meeting about what kind of a contact Mr. Colson might make with Mr. Hunt to reassure him on a personal basis. The purpose of the meeting was the Mr. Colson's strong desire to make a response to that letter, which was a very compelling letter. I believe it's in your exhibits. So that's how the meeting originated.
Well, Mr. Colson testified about this meeting in the context of Mr. Hunt being very concerned and that he might blow the lid off and indicate something which would be unsavory to the White House.
Mr. Colson said that?
I believe he did, or someone else in the testimony of these hearings.
Mr. Colson hasn't been here yet, Senator.
I don't mean Mr. Colson, Mr. Magruder.
Oh, Mr. Magruder wasn't there.
All right. Now, there was talk about clemency for some of the defendants at the White House, was there not?
At that meeting, there was talk about it, and the talk was that under no circumstances should it be offered, nor should it even be discussed.
Did you communicate this to Mr. Colson?
Yes, sir.
Were you aware that Mr. Caulfield had communicated an offer of clemency to Mr. McCord?
At that time?
I believe that was right after January the 3rd.
Oh, you mean at some other time did I
yes.
become aware of it?
Yes.
I heard of it quite a long time after it happened, yes, sir. And I heard of it during my inquiry during the interviews of some of these people.
Did Mr. Caulfield ever communicate to you that pursuant to word from Mr. Dean, he had communicated an offer of clemency to Mr.
No,
McCord?
No, sir.
Mm-hmm. And now, I will go into another matter. I believe you have testified here that when the President authorized an investigation of the Ellsberg matter, that he talked to Mr. Krogh, and that in that discussion there was no contemplation that a burglary should be committed.
It was never discussed.
All right. And I believe you also stated that you were unaware that Mr. Krogh or anyone else had given the authority, but your testimony was that you assumed that Mr. Krogh had given permission to go into the Ellsberg psychiatrist's office. You assumed.
Yes, sir.
I think that was your testimony.
That's correct.
All right. Now, let us go into the statute, which is 1825.11, subparagraph 3. I believe that you and your attorney tried to justify this as a legal venture and not a burglary because of this subparagraph 3, which gives to the president implied powers over the security of our nation. Now, if this particular thing or provision contemplates that the president takes such measures in order for them to be valid, if your interpretation is correct, the president did not take any measure to give authority. The Mr. Krogh, as you have testified, you just assume that he had authority, but you're not sure that he did. And therefore, there was no authority imparted from the only person that could give that authority for the commission of this burglary. And therefore, wouldn't you say that it was not a legal venture in promotion of the internal security of this country?
Well, Senator, my assumption was not with regard to whether Mr. Krogh had authority. My assumption was with regard to whether he had authorized the act by Mr. Hunt and Mr. Liddy.
Well, how could he authorize it if the president had not contemplated it when he gave the original charter for this investigation to Mr. Krogh?
Well, I suppose it's the difference between a general agency and what we used to call a special agency in law school.
But wouldn't you say that in view of the provision upon which you are relying, that specific authority from the only one who could give it, namely the President of the United States, was necessary in order to make it valid?
No, I would think that since we're talking about a constitutional rather than a statutory power, that a general delegation of capacity to Mr. Krogh would be required rather than some specific authorization of some specific act.
But this is not a statutory power. This is a recital of a reservoir of constitutional power in the president.
That's what I just said, Senator.
So in view of the fact that there was no specific authority, I'll ask you this question again, by the president, and in view of the fact that you are not sure whether Mr. Krogh had any authority to do so, and he certainly didn't under the wording of this, would you say that that burglary was legal?
Well, you're misstating what I understand about Mr. Krogh's authority. The thing that I said I had to assume was what passed between Mr. Krogh and Messrs. Hunt and Liddy, because I don't know. I do know what passed between the President and Mr. Krogh, and that was a delegation of very general authority on this subject. And in my opinion, that delegation of authority was very broad and very deep.
All right, now I might say to you, Mr. Ehrlichman, that your testimony has been contradicted by many of the witnesses who have appeared heretofore. And I believe that this committee has the task of judging your testimony against the testimony of others with respect to other matters of substance. And these other people are Mr. Dean, Mr. Mitchell, Mr. Magruder, Mrs. Strawn, Mr. LaRue, Mr. Kalmbach, and Mr. Sloan. I believe you have indicated in your testimony something contradictory of theirs in one manner or another, in one detail or another, and it is the duty of this committee to judge your testimony against this background and against all these threads of testimony offered by these individuals. And that's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I wouldn't want your remarks to go uncontradicted, Senator Montoya. I'm not aware of conflicts between my testimony and some of those that you read, number one. Number two, I understand the function of the committee to be legislative rather than adjudicatory. So I don't think that you're necessarily in the business of making findings of fact as to the testimony of specific witnesses. But passing that for the moment, it seems to me that whether there are conflicts in the evidence is not nearly as important as to whether or not conflicts in the evidence are supported, one side or the other, by corroborating independent evidence on material points. And I hope that you will find it possible, and the other members of the committee will find it possible, to examine the various extrinsic pieces of evidence, such as the letter from the CIA to the FBI and things of that kind, to determine which of conflicting testimony is entitled to the greater weight.
Well, I'm sure that we will do that. I personally will, I can assure you, Mr. Ehrlich.
Thank you, Senator.
I'll weigh the weight of the testimony, and I will also give consideration to any documentary evidence that you present here, and certainly I think all the members will.
That's good. Thank you.
Well, I think the prime function of this committee, one of the prime functions outside of making recommendations for legislation, is to find the facts, what the facts are. Well, from testimony of witnesses or from doctors. Senator Weicker.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me a moment. May this memorandum of April 6, which I passed to the chair, be included in the record at this point?
Yes, it's, the reporter will mark it as exhibit and admitted as such.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that a bell has just rung for a vote. This might be the proper time to go.
Well, we'll recess now and hurry back as fast as we can run.
Another recess, another vote. Senator Irvin promises that they will be as quick as possible. Senator Montoya just concluded his questioning of John Ehrlichman by asking in detail what I think was a very good question and producing a very startling answer in reply. Senator Montoya was talking about the break-in of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist office, and he pointed out that that the law, which Mr. Ehrlichman says authorizes this, says that only the president can authorize this. And he said, how could the Ellsberg break-in, how could it possibly be legal, since President Nixon, by his own words, didn't know about it and didn't authorize it, and as I recall, the president said would not have authorized it if he'd known about it. Mr. Ehrlichman said that the president early on had given Eagle Krogh a very broad, very deep, his words, delegation of general authority. In other words, that Mr. Krogh could authorize this break-in on his own and could presumably authorize a break-in on anyone else at any time, deciding on his own if he decided that national security somehow was at stake. As I say, there is another recess for another vote, a series of votes this afternoon on the Campaign Reform Act. So we'll be back with more on the Watergate affair in just a moment.
NBC's special coverage of the Senate Select Committee hearings will continue after this pause for station identification. John Chancellor and the award-winning NBC Nightly News tonight.
When our old dishwasher finally gave out, my husband and I decided that we wanted the best, so we bought a Maytag dishwasher. It does a fabulous job on pots and pans as well as dishes and glasses. I like the rinse and hold cycle, and that way I can leave my dishes in overnight and they'll still come out sparkling clean. I wish I had bought a Maytag to start with.
From the dependability people, the Maytag dishwasher. The one to...
See a live demonstration of Maytag dishwashers at Gordon's Appliance, Santa Maria.
Sparkless water is not created by magic or by accident. Sparklets goes through three different kinds of purification, plus many other steps to prepare it especially for drinking. We call this extra care and protection sparkletizing. And it's why Sparklets is always so crystal clear and delicious. So if you want drinking water you can really depend on, there's no trick to getting it. Just call Sparklets.
A miracle of nature brings a multitude of Northwest sweet cherries, a sensational buy this year.
Northwest cherries this week at Safeway. KNBC, Los Angeles.
As I say, another recess for another vote. So far today, the members of this committee have spent about as much time on the Senate floor as they've spent inside this committee room. That's because today the Senate is considering the Campaign Reform Act, and there's a long string of amendments being offered, so there are lots of votes on these amendments. This is an important bill. A bill which, in one way or the other, is going to affect the way politics run in this country for a long time to come. NBC's congressional correspondent, Paul Duke, has been following this Campaign Reform Act very carefully, and I wonder, Paul, if you could tell us a little about it now, and especially what all these amendments add up to. Are you there?
Yes, Doug. As you suggest, it's a Murray time on the old Senate floor today, and it's been that way since Wednesday. And it will be that way for much of next week. I understand there are approximately 50 amendments waiting to be voted on. We might first of all tell our viewers about a couple of the amendments which were voted on earlier. The Byrd Amendment, a motion sponsored by Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, for example, imposes stiff fines up to $25,000 and prison terms up to 10 years for those who misuse and misapply campaign funds. This is designed, obviously, to avoid things such as payments to burglars, Watergate burglars in this case. And that amendment was approved 88-1, just to show you the flavor of the debate and the mood for reform, which is certainly picking up in the Senate. The one senator who voted against the bill was Lee Metcalf of Montana, and he voted against the bill because he didn't think that it was tough enough. A short while ago, the Senate also approved an amendment by Senator Philip Hart of Michigan. I must correct myself. They rejected the Hart amendment by a 55-33 vote. This amendment was designed to limit campaign contributions by individuals to $1,000 per year. The bill, as it now stands, permits contributions of $3,000. I think, Doug, that we can say that, to use an old saying, that money is the root of most political evil. If you talk to the average politician, the average House member, the average senator, he will tell you that there is no greater evil than the fact that campaigns these days are so tremendously costly. It is not unusual, for example, to spend $200,000, $300,000 to run for a House seat. Senators spend between $500,000 and $1 million. It costs about $60 to $65 million to campaign for the presidency last year. The campaigns run by Mr. Nixon and by George McGovern. The reformers are now trying to do several things, basically. One of the things they are trying to do most of all is to eliminate large contributions. President Nixon got $2 million from one of his contributors, a Chicago businessman named Clement Stone. Mr. Stone also contributed $5 million to congressional candidates for House and Senate races. So there is a real desire on the part of the reformers to as much as possible,
transform politics so that politicians will rely principally among those who contribute from a great number. That is, to rely upon those who contribute to many candidates. In other words, a politician would not go to one man and get most of his campaign money. Another purpose is to require the disclosure of all contributors, to prevent such things as the laundering of campaign funds, that is, to send money to a bank in Mexico, for example, and to have it funneled back through that bank back into the United States. And most of all, many of the reformers are now leaning towards some kind of public financing, that is, to gain money from the public treasury to finance congressional campaigns, to finance the campaigns for the presidency. This, incidentally, is not a new concept. It's been advocated over the years by a number of people. Teddy Roosevelt advocated it back in the early 1900s. It has not caught on. It has not gained sufficient support to win passage. But it is certainly picking up a great deal of support now in the wake of Watergate. I would just like to make one other basic point, which many people now say, and that is that if you have public financing, it would free the Democrats from their reliance upon organized labor for most of their contributions, and it would free the Republicans from their reliance upon big business for most of their contributions. Doug?
Thank you, Paul. I might just say a word about the atmosphere inside this committee room right now at this moment. This is Friday afternoon, as I was saying earlier, and everybody is worn out, to put it bluntly. Members of the committee who have had to study this testimony after they finish every day and carry on a full legislative load while they are carrying on these hearings. The lawyers who work for the committee who have to pore over the testimony every day. The reporters who are there, the people who are all behind the witness are all members of the press one way or the other. And for them, I know as for me, it's as if you were studying for an examination. You must listen to every word that's said very carefully and write it down and then take a test on it. And the members of, it's a sort of a White House family, the members of the police detachment led by Lieutenant Blackston, who do such a good job in bringing spectators in and out. You'll notice as you look there, you'll see that policemen are scattered throughout the room. They're there for to look out for any demonstrations, of course, any disorders, but they're also there for another reason. About three or four people faint every day. Young women who come in out of the hot sunlight and perhaps are excited by being there and pressed close together in a room like that. The policemen keep a close eye out for them, and they take a great deal of pride in saying that so far nobody yet has hit the floor, that they've caught them before they've actually crumbled to the floor. They take them outside and give them a little smelling salts and put them back in commission. So it's a White House family, as I said, not a White House family, a caucus room family, and a very tired family at this point. Here's Senator Ervin, who is back from the Senate floor, and I suspect these hearings will be beginning any moment. There are also several regular spectators who show up every day for these hearings. They get no special privileges except that policemen get to know them. They come early, stay in line, and eventually sometimes even get a seat. Now the hearings again.
Senator Weichel, you may examine the witness.
Now, Mr. Ehrlichman, I'm going to refer to your opening statement before the committee, and specifically I'm on page 11 of that opening statement. And in the bottom paragraph, you state that the council also has always had political duties. The president is the nation's chief executive, but he is also, by long-standing tradition, his political party's leader. Any president has a political role to play, whether he's going to run for re-election or not. But if he's a candidate, then he is both an executive and a practicing politician. Every such politician wants information. And the president, in his politician role, is no different from the others. He needs and wants information about issues, supporters, opponents, and every other political subject known to man. For the year 69 to 70, when I left the post of counsel, I attempted to gather some purely political information for the president, as I was expected to do. Out of real concern for the proprieties, I attempted to use only conventional, non-governmental sources of information. As one might hire political aides in a political campaign, Tony Ulasewicz was hired to do this chore of information gathering. He was paid from existing Nixon political money by check under an appropriate employer's tax number. Among other assignments, he scouted the potential opposition for vulnerability. So far as I'm aware, during my tenure as counsel, Mr. Ulasewicz conducted his assignments legally and properly in all respects. Now I'd like to read to you from testimony given by Mr. Ulasewicz to this committee. Senator Weicker, now I'd like to, if I could, try to get into the general nature of the investigations, the other investigations which you conducted. Is it a fact that these investigations, or some of these investigations, were background checks on individuals intended to develop questionable facets of the personal lives of these individuals? Mr. Ulasewicz, that is correct, sir. Senator Weicker, now when we're talking about questionable facets, would this include sexual habits? Mr. Ulasewicz, these were allegations, and that might be included in the category, I guess. Senator Weicker, that would be included in the category. Drinking habits, Mr. Ulasewicz, yes, sir. Senator Weicker, domestic problems? Ulasewicz, yes, sir. Senator White, personal social activities? Mr. Ulasewicz, yes, sir. And then finally, in concluding his testimony, whereby he characterizes his information gathering, Mr. Ulasewicz responded, Senator Weicker, I repeat my question. How would you categorize the information which you turned over to Mr. Caulfield? So Ulasewicz, I would say it, Senator Weicker, was it of a national security nature? So Ulasewicz, no, sir. Senator Weicker, domestic security nature? So Ulasewicz, no, sir. Senator Weicker, dirt. So Ulasewicz, no, it would be of a political nature. Senator Weicker, political dirt. Mr. Ulasewicz, all right, sir. Now, since in your opening statement, you indicated that you were the one that was responsible in, when you were counsel to the president, in turning over political information, or information about issues, supporters, opponents, and every other political subject known to man, and since you were the one that hired Mr. Ulasewicz, I wonder if you might not comment to this committee as to the information which you turned over to the president, and again on the characterization that Mr. Ulasewicz gave his own job.
I don't know what period Mr. Ulasewicz was referring to in your, in response to your question, Senator. I can only speak for the about 6 or 7 months that his tenure and mine overlapped. I think that the investigations which he did at the time that I was counsel in 1969 and the first month or two, 1970 perhaps, did not in any way relate to the political campaign of 1972. So I don't know whether this is in the scope of your inquiry or not, but just generally...
Well, I think it's very much in the scope of the inquiry on the election campaign of 72, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, this covers the period after the 68 election up and through the 72 election.
Well, in any event, the one principal investigation that I recall, which Mr. Ulasewicz reported to me on, and I'm sorry that I don't have I don't think there were very many major ones of a political nature. My recollection is that a great deal of what he did had to do with Black Panthers and other violent group intelligence, and that's the other thing that stands out in my recollection. But Mr. Ulasewicz was sent to Edgartown to keep track of the development of the Chappaquiddick story. And it slips my mind as to just what the date of that was, but I do recall his keeping us informed on a regular basis of developments as they became available there.
And so you transmitted this information to the president?
In summary form, he produced almost nothing that wasn't a matter of newspaper reporting, as it turned out. So there was very little to pass on that would have been of any moment that you couldn't have read in an ordinary newspaper.
Well, of course, Mr. Ulasewicz testified that part of the information which he received was a matter of public record. Other information that he received was a matter of, or was received or gotten in an investigatory way. But why did you feel the necessity that to have somebody like Mr. Ulasewicz investigate the Black Panthers? Is there some reason why possibly the law enforcement arm, is this another area that J. Edgar Hoover was weak on?
No, he had his connection with the New York Police Department at one point in time had been in intelligence involving violent groups of that kind. And he had sources, particularly in the New York Police Department Intelligence Division. And so he would be the recipient of information because of that former association.
Well, I know, but that still isn't a satisfactory answer. Was there some inadequacy on the part of normal law enforcement agencies?
Right. I previously testified, I think, Senator, that we were not getting an accumulation of intelligence from the police and the sheriff's offices and the state police of the various municipal and state organizations, and that it was some time. I think it was probably the second year or possibly into the third year before there was set up in the Justice Department a facility for accumulating all of this. Mr. Ulasewicz, in the 6 or 7 months that he worked in the counsel's office when I was counsel, did a kind of a makeshift job of getting some of this information and feeding it in.
So the fact during this period of time, we all slept better at night knowing that Mr. Ulasewicz was on the job. Is that right?
Well, I don't know about that, Senator.
Well, I'm going to pursue this for a minute because let's get into the hiring of Mr. Ulasewicz. Was he brought down to the White House and interviewed for a job by the personnel at the White House? Just how was he hired?
He was hired because he was well known to Mr. Caulfield. Mr. Caulfield recommended him highly, and he was hired by me after a very brief meeting, but principally on Mr. Caulfield's say-so and recommendation.
Well, but where did you hire him?
Where did I hire him?
Right.
Well, I met him in an airport while I was on a trip to New York, as I recall. And Mr. Caulfield, as I recall it, arranged a meeting for us. I hired him, I guess, in the White House. That is, I made the decision and authorized Mr. Caulfield and made the arrangements with Mr. Kalmbach to pay him.
Your first meeting with him was in the VIP lounge at LaGuardia Airport.
That was the only meeting I ever had.
That was the only meeting?
Yes, sir.
So that is this some new situation whereby we're going to meet potential White House employees in the lounges of airports? Or,
well, as I tried to say in my opening statement, he was not a White House employee.
I see.
And he was never held out to be. And as a matter of fact, the very point of having him was that we were not gathering political information with government people. Well, I didn't feel that we ought to have government people in that business, that we ought to have a fellow who was established on the outside, who was paid on the outside. And you have this anomaly of having to conduct some political activities, both of a fundraising and of a staff and of an investigatory nature. And you do it with political funds, and they have to be outside people.
Well, isn't it true? Now, certainly neither one of us is in the position of being a novice here politically. The reason why you'd want him on an outside payroll would be that you wouldn't want to claim him if he were found out. Would that be a fair description?
Well, I don't think the way it was set up there'd be any way to disclaim him, Senator, because he was being paid very directly from Nixon campaign funds in the hands of a trustee committee, and there just was no way to disclaim it. There was no, everybody would be able to find out Mr. Ulasewicz's employer through just the employer number, if nothing else.
Well, I'll tell you, maybe everybody found out, maybe everybody knew, but we had to do an awful lot of digging around here to find out who Mr. Ulasewicz was and what role he had to go ahead and play. I'd like to have your concept, and I think this is very much, now we're getting into the real essence of the business of this committee. What is your concept of political information? You see, unfortunately, thanks to the committee re-elect the president and some of the witnesses that appeared here, everybody thinks that the senators at this table and others engaged in politics go running around hiring Ulasewicz types to dig up dirt on each other. And I just can't allow that to fly without contesting it, because really it's going to make elections rather interesting in the future if it does. And I wonder if you might, since you were the one that was responsible for hiring this man, and since we've had a description of by this man of exactly what his job consisted of, which was dirt, I wonder if you might tell the committee what your concept is of politics here in the United States insofar as this type of activity is concerned.
Well, I think that certainly there is room for improvement in the practice of politics in this country. There's no argument about that. But at the same time, I think that each candidate who contests the candidacy of an incumbent has the obligation to come forward and contest the fitness of that incumbent for office, both in terms of his voting record and in terms of his probity and in terms of his morals, if you please, and any other fact that is important or germane to the voters of his district or state, or the country for that matter. I think a candidate for office assumes that burden of proof. He assumes a burden of proof of showing the unfitness of the incumbent. And I don't think that in our political system that is limited to his voting record or his absenteeism. If it were, we would countenance the perpetuation of scoundrels in office who were thieves or who were fraudulent or who were profligate or otherwise unfit for office. And so I think it's perfectly competent for a challenger to meet head-on the issue of the fitness of an incumbent.
Do you mean to tell me in this committee that you consider private investigators going into sexual habits, drinking habits, domestic problems, and personal social activities as a proper subject for investigation during the course of a political campaign?
Senator, I know of my own knowledge of incumbents in office who are not discharging their obligation to their constituents because of their drinking habits. And it distresses me very much. And there's a kind of an unwritten law in the media that is not discussed. And so the constituents at home have no way of knowing that you can go over here in the gallery and watch a member totter onto the floor in a condition which of at least partial inebriation, which would preclude him from making any sort of a sober judgment on the issues that confront this country. Now, I think that is important for the American people to know, and if the only way that it can be brought out is through his opponent in a political campaign, then I think that opponent has an affirmative obligation to bring that forward.
Well, now this is getting very interesting. Again, we contrasted similar situations yesterday, and I'm just not going to let these things get laid out on the table without giving another side to the argument. I've had 8 election campaigns in 8 years, 6 against Democrats, 2 against Republicans. I suppose it would be considered self-serving to say that I've never done anything like that, so I won't, so I'll refer to my opponents. I know of no Democratic opponent out of the 6 and no Republican opponent out of the 2 that has ever done what Mr. Ulasewicz was doing, or what you are, in effect, advocating here. Now, it seems to me that it's up to the constituency, whatever that constituency happens to be, to make a determination as to the fitness of the man or the woman that they go ahead and elect. But do you really want to bring the political system of the United States, of our campaigns, down to the level of what you're talking about right now?
Well, I conceive of it this way, Senator. I know that in your situation, your lifestyle's undoubtedly impeccable, and there wouldn't be anything at issue like that.
Believe me, I'm not, and I worry about you sicking people on the landscape here. I've probably got a greater worry now that I've heard about this than I did before I started it. I'll put it that way.
Well, but I think you'll agree with me, Senator, that certainly someone with a serious drinking habit is of doubtful fitness for the kind of heavy duties that you bear, for instance, or that any senator bears in the Senate of the United States. That is certainly a material question that has to be raised in a political campaign, at least so it seems to me. Now, if that is not something that the incumbent's opponent should bring out, then you are leaving the constituency to the tender mercies of the journalists in the community as to whether or not that's reported to the constituency, because they don't have any way of knowing, really, especially the constituencies remote from here, where people get here very seldom to make an observation. So I would be very concerned about that, and that seems to me to be a very legitimate subject of inquiry. Now, maybe my standards are all haywire, and that everybody in the Congress ought to be immune from scrutiny on that subject. But that just seems to me to be an indefensible position on your part.
You think that we have no scrutiny around here?
Sir?
You think we have no scrutiny
around
here?
Well, in all candor...
Let's count them. I mean, they're all over here at this stage of the game, and they're here all the time, not just to hear you and I talk. If there's anything that... It's quite obvious in Washington, D.C., it's that every aspect of our lives, legislatively, personally, in every way, is subject to the scrutiny of a free press. And subject to the scrutiny, at least the Congress is subject to the scrutiny of the free press. And also subject to the scrutiny of our constituencies. Our wives, right. I want to state right now, and obviously you and I are at loggerheads on a very basic issue here, and one that I think not only relates to Mr. Ulasewicz's activities. I'm not so sure we don't come right back to the break-in in Daniel Ellsberg's office again. That I am quite satisfied that our systems our institutions are perfectly capable of passing decent judgments, fair judgments, hard judgments on political figures, public officials, without the covert operations of men like Mr. Ulasewicz.
Senator, I would only disagree with you by saying this much. I think that your assumptions with regard to the full reportage by the media of the personal conduct of people in public life gilds the lily unduly. Certainly, you members of this committee are being subjected to scrutiny by the television and by the writing press to a degree, and your conduct is being evaluated and measured in a way that seldom happens to a member of the United States Senate or the Congress of the United States. And I think it is possible for some members to exist in a sheltered situation for years and years and years here and perpetuate themselves in office, so to speak, because you know and I know that the advantages are heavily in favor of the incumbent. You are in a position to favor reporters with stories and so on. It's an uphill struggle for someone to take on an incumbent United States Senator under any circumstances. And the press are not always as tough on others as they might be on the members of this committee in this setting. So I think you and I have a difference of opinion, but I think that reasonable minds can differ on this subject, particularly in the area of drinking, the area of fitness of that kind to discharge the duties. Now, certainly there are limits, and I would be the first to agree with you that there are areas where a subject matter that would be totally offensive to me as they would be to you. And I don't mean for a minute to contend for matters beyond those limits. But I do think that that's one of the things that this whole proceeding is about, I think, is an attempt to try and define the lines within which an inquiry as to an incumbent, his life, his performance, his voting record, are subject of proper inquiry.
Yeah, but I mean, if this is a matter of proper inquiry in the course of an election campaign, I mean, why isn't it a proper, why isn't it proper inquiry as far as all members of Congress are concerned, insofar as the relationship between the executive and the branch and the legislative branch? Why not? Is this material, in other words, that's going to be used as between the executive and the legislative branches of government?
I don't think I understand.
Well, you apparently consider it proper information to dig out to go ahead and win an election. Is it proper information to dig out to go ahead and carry an issue?
You mean blackmail? No, I don't.
I mean as between the legislative and the executive branches of government.
You mean, in other words, you have a piece of information and
right.
You go to a congressman and say,
right.
Congressman, we need... No, I don't think that's proper.
But it's proper in an election campaign.
I think it is proper to provide legitimate facts to an electorate that bear on the fitness of an incumbent.
Well, of course, what you're saying and where we disagree, and I want to make this clear, Mr. Chairman, if any other member of the committee wants to comment now, I don't think anybody realizes what's being done here right now. You definitely have two different concepts of politics in this country meeting head on.
I might say, Senator, that
let me
this
finish
is...
and then I'll be glad to go ahead and listen to you.
Sure.
I always thought that we settle these matters on the basis of issues, on what you stood for, on a public stance that your opponent took that was a bad stance, how you can present yourself, how you move around in campaign. But to sit here at this moment in time and tell me that we're going to settle our elections on the basis of sexual habits and drinking habits and domestic problems and personal social activities, well, I'll tell you stick to your version, I'm going to stick to mine.
Senator, I was going to say that in what we have asked the FBI to do, to determine the fitness of an individual for appointment to the executive branch, to the cabinet, the sub-cabinet, to the agency positions and so on, these kinds of questions of fitness, drinking habits, habitual intoxication, immorality, are all considered to be important questions to ask and to settle upon. And the review, as far as I know, in the selection of people in this administration has been very rigorous, and the standards have been very high.
Well, number one, please don't put the FBI in the same category as Mr. Ulasewicz. Now, I just don't think that's a fair comparison at all. I think these are two entirely different entities. I am proud of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
The subjects are the same, Senator.
I might add, you keep on talking about the enormous advantage that an incumbent enjoys. May I point out that according to your theory, the president was the incumbent.
Oh, I don't...
He was the incumbent.
Please don't misunderstand me. I think an incumbent president has an enormous advantage.
Yeah, but this one not only had an enormous advantage, apparently you went around and had this type of information handed to him, which added to the advantage that he had, I would say, made him rather unbeatable. Well, in any event, let's leave that subject for the time being, although I find that unbelievable. Yeah. Yesterday, in response to a series of questions concerning the need for the plumbers, you stated as follows, and I assure you that the decision that was made in this matter to put investigators in the field was taken most reluctantly and for genuine purposes. And the purposes are simply to supplement what was considered to be an inadequate effort at the time by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Now, in order to satisfy yourself on this, you ought to hear from Mr. Mitchell. That was your response. You will find that, incidentally, Counselor. You have the transcript on page 5535 of yesterday's testimony. Now, in order for you to satisfy yourself on this, you want to hear from Mr. Mitchell. Well, now, we have already heard from Mr. Mitchell, and he testified before this committee that the first that he had heard of the White House horrors, the plumber's operation, was on June 21, 1972. This was after he had left as Attorney General. Is Mr. Mitchell lying?
As I said in my testimony the other day, Senator, Mr. Mitchell's recollection here is evidently hazy because the President authorized the creation of this unit on the 24th of July and asked that we meet with several members of the Cabinet who
24th
were,
of July, 71?
Yes, sir. To meet with several members of the Cabinet whose departments would be the subject of the special unit's stimulation, so to speak, to get them to perform better in this area of leaks. On the 28th of July, we had that meeting with Mr. Mitchell, at which Mr. Young, Mr. Krogh, and I briefed Mr. Mitchell on the President's desires, on the purpose of the special unit, and what it would be doing.
On what date was this?
July 28th.
1971?
Yes, sir.
So that when Mr. Mitchell said that the first he learned of the White House horrors was on June 21, there's been some debate, it might have been June 20th, 1972, that was inaccurate. Is that
yes,
right?
Sir.
Well, the answer's that. Now, I'm going to follow through some dates and times with you, Mr. Ehrlichman. On the 20th or 21st of June, 1972, Mr. Mitchell, according to his testimony, learned for the first time, which you just indicated was not true, but it was a false. According to his testimony, learned for the first time the Ellsberg break-in and other activities of the plumbers, which he called the White House horrors. And Mr. Mitchell was shocked by these revelations and feared the disclosure of these events might cost the president the election. That's what he testified to in front of this committee. Now, the next day, June 22nd, 1972,
your office.
I beg your pardon. The next day, Mr. Mitchell met with you at your office at 11:45 a.m. Do you have that on your log?
Yes, sir.
Which meeting followed a group meeting he had attended with you at 9 o'clock?
Right.
And which meeting followed a phone call between you and Mr. Mitchell at 11:20 a.m.? That's on Mr. Mitchell's, according to Mr. Mitchell's log. Phone call, in other words, he met with you at 9, or it was at a group meeting with you at 9 o'clock on the 22nd in the morning. Mr. Mitchell's log showed that he had a phone conversation with you at 11:20 on June the 22nd. And then at 11:45, he meets with you. Now, what did you and Mr. Mitchell discuss at your 11:45 a.m. meeting that you could not discuss either at 9 o'clock when you met with the group or at 11:20 on the phone?
I don't know, Senator. Does his log show whether he originated that phone call or I did? Because I cannot reconstruct that meeting. I just do not know what that meeting was about.
You mean the 11:45 meeting?
Yes, sir.
No.
It would depend, and it would help me to reconstruct, to know whether I had placed it, in which case probably the president had asked me to refer something to him, or whether he had placed it, but I just draw a blank on it, I'm sorry to say.
Do you think there's any possibility, considering the fact that Mr. Mitchell had received the report from Messrs. LaRue and Marty either the day before or 2 days before, depending on which version it was, that he specifically discussed with you this problem of the break-in, the White House horrors, and his fear as to what it would do in the election?
I would suggest that it had not happened that way for this reason. I suspect that this meeting was convened for the reason contained in the phone call, whatever that was. And I'm sorry to say I don't know what it was, but had it been something that was in his mind in the morning when we all got together at 9:30 or 10, he most likely would have stayed back, as sometimes happened with some of those people in the meeting. From time to time, Clark McGregor, for instance, would stay back after everybody else left, and we would talk about something that he had on his mind. Now, I'm really surmising there. I just don't know. I can tell you this, that at no time did Mr. Mitchell express to me his concerns, which he described here to the committee, about the so-called horrors.
At no time?
I do not recall his ever doing so.
All right. On the same day, according to Mr. Gray's statement to this committee, and General Walter's memo of June 28, 1972, Mr. Gray routinely inquired into the possible CIA involvement in the Watergate case and was told by Director Helms that there was no involvement. The next day, on June the 23rd, you and Mr. Haldeman called Mr. Helms and General Walters to a meeting in your office, which meeting General Walters characterized as follows. And I think it important to read this memorandum. Memorandum for the record. This is General Walters, 28 June 1972. On June 23rd at 1300 on request, I called with Director Helms on John Ehrlichman and Robert Haldeman in Ehrlichman's office at the White House. Haldeman said that the bugging affair at the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate apartments had made a lot of noise, and the Democrats were trying to maximize it. The FBI had been called in and was investigating the matter. The investigation was leading to a lot of important people, and this could get worse. He asked what the connection with the agency was, and the director repeated that there was none. Haldeman said that the whole affair was getting embarrassing, and it was the president's wish that Walters call on acting FBI director Pat Gray and suggest to him that since the five suspects have been arrested, that this should be sufficient and that it was not advantageous to have the inquiry pushed, especially in Mexico, etc. May I stop here for 1 second? The reason for my reading this memorandum to you is that obviously there are 4 participants in this meeting, and I want each one to have a chance to go ahead and comment on it, and even though all of it doesn't apply to you, you are there. You're one of the participants of this meeting. Director Helm said that he had talked to Gray on the previous day and made it plain to him that the agency was not behind this matter, that it was not connected with it, and none of the suspects was working for nor had worked for the agency in the last 2 years. He had told Gray that none of his investigations was touching any covert projects of the agency, current or ongoing. Haldeman then stated that I could tell Gray that I had talked to the White House and suggested that the investigation not be pushed further. Gray would be receptive as he was looking for guidance in the matter. The director repeated that the agency was unconnected with the matter. I then agreed to talk to Gray as directed. Ehrlichman implied I could do this. It looks like I should. I don't want to say something that's incorrect there. I should do this soon, and I'll get a clean copy. And I said I would try to do it today. On leaving the White House, I discussed the matter briefly with the director. On returning to the office, I called Gray, indicated this was a matter of some emergency, and he agreed to see me at 14:30 that day. Now, that's General Walters. Mr. Helms stated to this committee during an interview as follows. A few minutes later, Haldeman and Ehrlichman walked in, and Haldeman, in no uncertain terms, instructed Walters to see Pat Gray at the FBI and instruct him not to pursue his investigation in Mexico concerning Ogerio and Dahlberg, since it might involve the CIA. Helms had no idea what they were talking about with respect to Mexico, and when he asked, was told, never mind what it's all about, but they wanted Walters to go to Pat Gray right then and there. End of quote in the interview with Mr. Helms. Now, isn't it a fact that the meeting with Director Helms and General Walters on June 23rd was an effort to hinder the Watergate investigation?
Senator, that meeting was convened at the President's request. I learned later that the President was operating on the basis of an independent source of information and out of a concern that an all-out FBI investigation might compromise some CIA activity. My recollection of that meeting is at considerable variance with General Walters in the general thrust and in the details. In point of fact, as I recall, we informed Mr. Helms and General Walters that the meeting was being held at the President's request for the reasons that I just stated. Mr. Haldeman said that the Watergate was an obvious, important political issue, and that the President had no alternative but to order a full, all-out FBI investigation unless he was satisfied that there was some specific area in which the FBI should not probe for fear of leaks through the FBI of disassociated and disconnected CIA activities that had no bearing on Watergate. As I recall, there were a couple of basic questions that were asked of these gentlemen. One was whether the CIA was directly involved in the break-in itself, and they said it was not. The other was whether or not there were any disassociated CIA activities, past or present, which might somehow be disclosed through a vigorous FBI investigation. They did not make the same kind of a categorical negative response to that question as they had made to the other. As a matter of fact, my recollection is a response to the effect that they don't keep track, that is the director and the deputy director, of these regional activities, such as the one in Mexico. They would want to check with a regional man. Now, you have in your...
But they'd done that.
Sir?
They had done that.
No, I think their letter of the 6th of July to the acting director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation shows that they had not done that. And they did not do that, and they did not assure the FBI until the 27th of June as to the Mexican situation. And then they confirmed that oral assurance of the 27th of June in writing on the 6th of July, and on the 6th of July is when Director Gray called the President and said, I now have a memo from the CIA assuring me that there is no problem, and the president said, let's go all out. So that is the sequence of events.
Why did the director call the president?
Because he received, I assume it's because he had this memorandum.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Why did the director call the president?
Point of fact, I think the president called the director.
That's correct. The director had called Mr. McGregor.
That's true.
And he had expressed to Mr. McGregor doubts as to this situation. He felt this was the best way to go ahead and get in touch with the president. The president called him back shortly thereafter.
Well, I wasn't at the meeting between Mr. Gray and Mr. McGregor, so I don't know what they said, but I do know that told me that Mr. McGregor said to him when he came and called on the president on the 6th of July that he had been talking to Pat Gray and that Pat Gray felt it was important that he talk with the president right away, and the president picked up the phone immediately and called him.
And Pat Gray tell the president of his fears that there were those around him that were trying to wound him?
I had never heard that.
Is it not a fact that General Walters and Pat Gray both felt it was necessary to call the president on this matter, that both of them had the same apprehensions that the investigation was being interfered with?
I think it was important for Pat Gray to have talked with the president, too. I heartily concurred with that. I hope you understand that when Mr. Haldeman and I met with the CIA, it was for the purpose only of conveying to those gentlemen the president's concern, and the meeting did not culminate in any instructions to anyone except a request to General Walters that he sit down and talk to Pat Gray about this matter and reassure Pat Gray if he could be factually reassured. Now, that in fact is what happened, and Mr. Haldeman and I disconnected from this after that one 20-minute meeting.
All right, let's drop back in time again here to the meeting on June 23rd. You're sitting here with the director of the CIA and with General Walters. Now, wouldn't it be logical to address any request of the CIA to the director of the CIA?
Not if you were told by the president that he wanted to work through General Walters.
Now, let me repeat Mr. Helms' testimony, or his interview with this committee. Helms had no idea what they were talking about with respect to Mexico, and when he asked, was told, never mind what it's all about. But they wanted Walters to go to Pat Gray right then and there.
The president's instructions were not to me, they were to Mr. Haldeman, and he's going to be your best witness as to those instructions. But my understanding of those instructions secondhand is that the president said that he wanted General Walters and Pat Gray to work this out between them. And that was confirmed to me by the president a later time, but I didn't know it at the time of this meeting.
And then we also have General Walters' memorandum, which I've read to you, in which he indicates concern over the Watergate investigation in a political sense. And you disagree with that?
The memorandum that you read to me was dated the 28th of June, which was considerably after...
5 days after.
And as a matter of fact, after the CIA finally determined that it had no involvement or exposure on the 27th and orally informed the Bureau to that effect. It was then and only then that General Walters sat down and reconstructed these meetings.
So, in effect, your testimony stands in conflict with the versions of that meeting told by, as I've read them to you, of both General Walters and Director Helms.
Yes, sir.
Now we're getting somewhere. One last series of questions, Mr. Chairman, then I'll move on here. I'd like to, if we could, get to the taped telephone conversations, the conversations which you taped. Do you have both those before you?
Which are those?
These would be the two. I find it strange in the United States we say, which are those, as if this were the normal practice. These are the conversations with Pat Gray on March 7th or 8th, and the follow-up conversation with John Dean the same day, whatever day that happens to be. You have those?
We have that.
And I wonder if at this time, if we might not, Mr. Chairman, have these entered as exhibits.
Oh. What does she want entered as exhibits? I didn't quite get what you wanted to enter as exhibits.
The transcriptions of the two tape telephone conversations, the first between Mr. Ehrlichman and Pat Gray, the second one between Mr. Ehrlichman and John Dean.
Did Mr. Ehrlichman identify the one that he was party to?
He was party to both, Mr. Chairman.
The two papers will be marked exhibit and admitted as such. I'm sorry, I thought maybe you were late referring to the General Walters matter. Is there a pending question, Mr. Chairman?
I don't know. I've just been trying to make sure that Mr. Ehrlichman has a chance to look over the material. I'm ready to go whenever you're ready.
That's fine.
All right, let's get first to the conversation between yourself and Pat Gray. The first portion of it, let me try to synopsize that. Gray makes some preliminary... unless you want the whole thing read. If you want the whole thing read, we can do that. Would that be better to handle it that way so there won't be any unfair...
No, why don't you just ask whatever you have on your mind, Senator, and then see if I can answer.
Well, Pat Gray makes some preliminary remarks concerning his position that the judiciary... These are phone conversations, March 7th or 8th, 1973, when Pat Gray is before the Judiciary Committee, subject of his confirmation. Gray made some preliminary remarks concerning his position that the Judiciary Committee could only question his procedural conduct in the investigation, not the substance, since the Irvin Committee would do that. He also pointed out that the very same day, the ACLU submitted a letter to the committee stating the same position. Gray then went on to say, quote, and now I'm going into the exact quote. And this is Gray to Ehrlich. The thing I want to talk to you about is that I'm being pushed awfully hard in certain areas, and I'm not giving an inch. And you know those areas. And I think you've got to tell John Wesley to stand very tight in the saddle and be very careful about what he says and to be absolutely certain that he knows in his own mind that he delivered everything he had to the FBI and doesn't make any distinction between, and then something goes on, it's inaudible, but that he delivered everything to the FBI. Now, what did you assume this to mean? What's he talking about here when he says, and you know those areas?
I assumed he was talking about the method of delivery of the contents of Hunt's safe, the fact that some went to the Washington field office and some went to the director directly.
Ehrlich. Right. Gray. And that he delivered it to those agents. This is absolutely imperative. Ehrlich, all right. Gray, you know, I've got a couple of areas up there that I'm hitting hard and I'm just taking them on the attack. Ehrlichman, okay. Gray, I wanted you to know that. Ehrlichman, good. Keep up the good work, my boy. Let me know if I can help. Gray, all right. He can help by doing that. Ehrlichman, good. I'll do it. You then immediately called Mr. Dean, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And I'd like to go ahead, if we could, and read this conversation. Dean, hello. Ehrlich, hi, I just had a call from your favorite witness. Dean, which is? Ehrlichman, Patrick J. Gray. Dean, oh really? Ehrlichman, and he says to make sure that old John W. Dean stays very, very firm and steady on his story that he delivered every document to the FBI, and that he does not start making nice distinctions between agents and directors. Dean, he's a little worried, is he? Ehrlichman, well, he just doesn't want there to be any question. He says he's hanging very firm, and there's a lot of probing around. Dean, yeah, he's really hanging tough. You ought to read the transcript. He makes me gag. Ehrlichman, really? Dean, oh, it's awful, John. Ehrlichman, why did he call me? To cover his tracks? Dean, yeah, sure. I laid this on him yesterday. Ehrlichman, oh, I see. Okay. Dean, I laid it on him to, you know, defuse the issue, so I don't have any idea what he set up there today. Ehrlichman, I see. It was a funny phone call. Said he's going in to object to the jurisdiction of the group to get into the substance, and that their only jurisdiction was to, and again, inaudible there, to procedural efforts and his competence, and he says the ACLU put a letter in to the same effect. Dean, yeah, Wally picked up an interesting one on the grapevine today. The plan strategy now is to proceed in this one as it did in Kleindienst. Ehrlichman, down to the point of calling you. Dean, down to the point of calling me. Ehrlichman, let him hang there. Well, I think we ought to let him hang there. Let him twist slowly, slowly in the wind. Dean, that's right. And I was in with the boss this morning, and that is exactly where he was coming out. He said, I'm not sure Gray is smart enough to run the Bureau the way he's handling himself. Ehrlichman, well, okay, you're on top of it. Good. Now, Mr. Ehrlichman, first of all, that portion of the transcript, which the dean says, yes, sure, I laid this on him yesterday, and you say, oh, I see, okay. What is being referred to there?
I don't know. I don't know and never did know, I don't think, what Mr. Dean had talked to him the previous day about. I was looking, as you were reading, to see if I could see what had been transpiring in that particular week in those hearings. And it seems to me that the issue was primarily whether Dean sat in on the interviews that the FBI conducted during the Watergate investigation, and the question of whether Dean would come to the Judiciary Committee and testify. I think that this was one of a series of telephone calls that Mr. Gray made to me and to Mr. Dean at the close of his testifying every day to